We're just going to let it record.
Okay, cool.
Now, do you think we can do this without coming across as too artificial on either side?
I don't think that's possible. No, that's maybe. Yeah, there's any kind of artificiality.
Right.
In anything you
record doing, or
anything recording, and yeah.
Yeah, everyone is self-aware or yeah, anyway, okay. Let's get this started.
Okay.
Jason, thanks for coming today. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for having me, man. Thanks for the wonderful lunch. So, yeah.
Anytime, we'll have to do this again.
Yeah.
Sometime when we don't have microphones in front of our faces.
Right.
All right. Well, I asked you to come because I wanted to find out a little bit more about your publishing company.
Okay.
I guess it's not a publishing company, but you have a small.
Well,
press,
technically it is. Yeah. Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about that. It's called Two Cranes Press.
That's right. Yeah, Two Cranes Press, and we've been doing some pretty small stuff here, for the last few years. The first thing we did was a chapbook that was in October of 2002. It was a chapbook of fiction from me and from my wife Janet.
Right.
And we debuted that at the World Fantasy Convention in Washington, and have just about sold out. We've got a few more copies that are coming from Chicago, but we're just about sold out of that. But
what was your initial print run on that?
That was only 100. We were, because we were pretty new and we were trying to figure out, you know, what we were doing as we were doing it, we wanted to start small, and also we didn't know, you know, if anybody was going to buy our stuff. So,
sure.
So there's always that hesitancy when, you know, you don't want to overblow your production run and then have 500 copies sitting in a warehouse somewhere that nobody's going to buy. So
right.
Yeah, so we started with 100 and actually did that when Janet was still in Singapore, and so we got them printed there because it's much, much cheaper to print something in Singapore than it is here, and that's kind of a little known fact in the publishing world is that Singapore is one of the major publishers, or I guess printers,
mm-hmm.
out there, that a lot of textbooks are actually printed there. So because of that, they can be very competitive in their pricing. So
right.
We decided to go with them.
Well, I wanted to ask you about the print costs eventually, but mm-hmm. Maybe we'll come back to that in a little bit later time during the interview. You guys were actually not married at the time when you started the chapbook, right?
No, that's right. We had, let's see, by that point we were engaged, but we weren't married yet. So I had gone over to Singapore in May of 2002, and that's actually when I proposed.
Mm-hmm.
And we started talking about this stuff, I guess, in July, and we were there were a few things. There was like Cafe Press, the online place where you can do like a whole bunch of print-on-demand shirts and caps and thong underwear, that kind of stuff, if you want to. They started doing a book publishing option, and I was like, you know, that'd be kind of cool to do. You know, we haven't really done anything like that. That'd be kind of fun. And she brought up the idea that because Singapore is so such a good place to get stuff published, that, you know, we might as well just do it there. It's going to be cheap. We're going to be able to make our money back pretty easily. And so we just decided to do it that way. And I believe we made back our costs after selling half of the copies. So,
oh, that's good.
Yeah, so everything after that was gravy.
Well, I wanted to ask you, because you sort of hinted at this anyway, but one of the questions that I was interested in was finding out what actually inspired you to start your own small press. I mean, did you know when you printed the first one that you were going to keep doing more, or was that really just the trial run for a larger project? Or did you have it already in the back of your mind, I'm going to start my own small press?
We hadn't really thought about that. We were thinking originally that just to do this, you know, this one chapbook and just put it out there and see how it does.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess based on the success of that and the fact that, and the biggest thing was we were able to sell all the copies, more or less. So it was, that was kind of, I wouldn't say it was a trial run, but it was definitely, we wanted to see how that did first, mm-hmm. before we did anything else. So we didn't really have, I mean, we had to create the small press in order to print that. I guess we didn't have to, but I guess just for credibility's sake, we had a press name.
And you already had the press name before this first chapbook?
We didn't,
right?
Actually. When we were coming up with the idea of doing it, we had to come up with a name, and there were a few things that were tossed around. I can't remember. I think one was like Salt Road Press, maybe. But there were a few things that Janet had seen that involves two cranes. It's kind of the crane in Chinese mythology is a symbol of longevity and good luck, and basically just all, you know, a lot of good things.
And I assume that that there are two cranes because there are two of you. Is that right?
That's the big reason.
As opposed to three or four crane.
Right.
Press, yeah.
Right. Well, and we also saw, Janet saw mostly, there were a lot of pieces of artwork that had two cranes together. Hmm. And I'm not sure if it's cranes mate for life. I have no idea about that. But there were a lot of things that she was saying that had two cranes in them.
Mm-hmm.
And we were kind of the two cranes. So.
Right.
So we ended up picking that, yeah.
Well, that segues nicely into the question about the artwork.
Mm-hmm.
Janet does most of the artwork for, she's done most of the artwork for the first two
mm-hmm.
chapbooks. Is that right?
She did all the artwork. She's done all the artwork, basically. She mm-hmm. has been in the art department. So she did for the first book and for the anthology, but for Four Seasons in One Day was our first chapbook. She did all of the artwork and all the book design
mm-hmm.
and... did that all, you know, like I said, in Singapore. And there was actually the cover for the chapbook was based on... There was a painting she had done, I don't know how many years ago, it was a long time ago, that she had done maybe like 10 years ago. That was kind of what we were looking at. As we were kind of assembling what we wanted to put out there, I knew we didn't want to have any already published stories in there, and so everything that was in there was unpublished. And
okay.
As I was looking at the stuff that I wanted to publish of mine, I noticed that there was kind of a seasonal theme going on, and one takes place in winter and one's in the autumn, and she had a story that takes place in the summer in Australia, and so we came up with this idea of the four seasons. It's a Australian term. I think it's specific to Melbourne. That's what KJ Bishop has told me, that the four seasons in one day, it can be just really, the weather can be really unpredictable, mm-hmm. and so you can have all four seasons in
right.
one day. So we came up with that because there's obviously the four tales, and you can read it in one day. And
right.
So, yeah. It's also a really good Crowded House song.
Oh, right. It's funny because when I was listening to you actually describe the title and sort of the meaning behind it, I sort of almost thought of a Neil Gaiman title. It almost
yeah.
sounds like a sort of a mini series that he would have done with the Sandman or something. You know, four seasons in one day.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate it in comparison to Neil Gaiman.
Well, it's a catchy title, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think so too. It's a really great phrase, and when we were coming up with the book, and actually after we had gotten the title, and we were developing the website, I came up with the idea of doing kind of a fake history behind the website.
That's right. I actually asked you about that at one point because
right.
I was very incredulous.
Yeah.
that couldn't possibly be true, what
right.
you're telling me there.
Right. And it's, I call it the somewhat true history of True Cranes Press, Two Cranes Press, but it's completely fake.
Yeah, the somewhat, just about to say, how much of that is true?
Right, right.
But you had gay grandfathers, you and
Jim. Well, I don't actually say that, but I say there was a friendship between our ancestors, and there was a woman that came between them, and yeah, a whole lot of stuff, but
mm-hmm.
yeah, it's total crap. So.
Right.
But I thought it was fun. There was there have been a few writers that have done that have, like Jeff Vandermeer comes to mind. He has at the back of... City of Saints and Madmen, he's got a fake biography, and so
mm-hmm.
I just thought it'd be fun to do that, and it's, you know, coming up with a fake history, and
well, so. I was entertained, you know,
yeah.
definitely. So.
Well, that's good, that's, yeah.
And felt significantly moved enough to ask you whether or not any of that was true, or
right.
it was all horseshit.
Right, but, yeah, and I like the idea of adding to the confusion that, you know, we can tell our true history, but, you know, it's kind of boring, so you know,
sure.
you might as well make something up. And
oh, I don't know if that's true or not. I mean, anybody who has to go through an international marriage process
right.
Has faced his or her share of frustration
that's true.
Colorful situations.
So. Yeah, yeah.
But, you've got scattered, covered, smothered. Is that right? Did I say
yeah.
that right?
Mm-hmm.
Right in front of you.
You should know you're in here.
I know I'm in here, but sometimes, you know, that it's a catchy title, but sometimes
yeah.
I forget things. So Your print run was much larger with this one, wasn't it?
Well, not much larger. We went from 100 on the chat book to 250 for this one. Or it was 230, I think, actually. Yeah, because we were going to do originally 200, and then there were like 30 contributors in here, including yourself.
Right.
So I decided to go to 230 instead to... because I had to give all of you contributors a copy, so
right.
So we went with that. But yeah, it was 230 copies,
right?
And we are almost sold out of this one too, or about 15 copies left. So
well, that's good. I've been really impressed with all the marketing and all the campaigning you've done for it.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to ask you though, when did you actually start the process, and how many submissions did you eventually? Have, and then how many did you take?
Let's see. Well, we started, again, this was in July. I don't know why these things always happen in July, but this was in July of last year, and we were talking about, we'd had a lot of fun with doing the chapbook and selling them, and being, this is something that we were really proud of, and the printing came out just really, really well, and so we were happy with that, and so... I'm not sure what exactly sparked it, but we were just talking one day about different zines that are out there, and the friends of ours, that most notably the couple friends of ours, it's like Kelly Link and Gavin Grant with Small Beer Press.
I was about to say, yeah.
Yeah, and Heather Shaw and Tim Pratt with Tropism Press, and they do Flytrap, and they also do a chapbook series of their own thing. And then there's... Christopher Rowe and Gwenda Bond, who do the Say zine.
Yeah, which I mentioned.
Right, which Janet actually had a story in, I think, issue 4. It was Say, Why Aren't We Crying? But it was unusual. It was kind of interesting to see all these artistic couples that were putting these zines together, and we thought, well, you know, why can't we do that? That'd be kind of fun. And mm-hmm. we'd already done our own fiction, so it'd be kind of fun to edit an anthology of other people's fiction.
Right.
So... And we were talking about, we wanted to do an anthology instead of a zine because, for a few reasons. One reason is that bookstores will be more likely to buy, or at least stock, your book if it's a book, as opposed to just a zine, unfortunately, which I wish more bookstores would stock those because they're really great little magazines, but mm-hmm. They'll be more likely to stock your book if it's a book. And we also weren't sure if this was going to be a one-shot thing or if we wanted to do a series. Right now, we still haven't made that decision. Right now, it's still just a one-shot anthology. But
So you're actually contemplating whether or not to go forward with the idea of what, another food-related anthology?
Possibly, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or even something else, but that'll be in the future a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so that was the thinking, is that we just do, you know, a one-shot kind of thing. And so
I think it's probably important to actually mention the premise behind the whole book, because at this point we've
right.
just kind of discussed print run and such, but it is a food related tome, so to speak, right?
Right, right. It's cooking and food related fiction, and also some real recipes in there. Yours is one of them, but and some poetry as well. But we wanted to make sure that it was food related, because Janet and I both love food, and especially she's a really good cook, and so we thought this would just be a really fun idea, and we haven't really seen anything like this. There mm-hmm. might be something out there, but we haven't seen it, and especially nothing that was really kind of friendly to speculative fiction, because the majority of the stories, not all of them, but the majority are kind of a speculative or fantastical element in them.
Right.
But because I read both in spec fic and in the mainstream, I was taking anything. I was, or not taking anything, but I was looking at anything. It didn't have to be science fiction. It didn't have to be fantasy or anything. It could be just a mainstream, quiet story, and we have a few of those in here
right.
that are just really beautifully told.
And so how many submissions did you get for this? Because you you were telling me earlier over lunch that you had a lot and you only printed out a certain number to actually
yeah.
read.
Yeah, there were, God, I can't even remember now. We had quite a few, though. I think we had a few hundred, at least. I'm thinking we had about 200 submissions, mm-hmm. which for, and we were only paying a flat fee. We only paid each of the authors a $10 flat fee and then mm-hmm. a copy of the book. So to get that, I was very surprised to get that many submissions, and we got some.
Well, that really is a lot.
Yeah, it is, and yeah. and a lot. I had to after a while. There's kind of a threshold where editors will tell you they'll stop reading, and as the months went on, we had a 3-month reading period, and as the months went on,
I was going to ask, yeah,
yeah. My threshold got smaller and smaller and smaller, where sometimes it was only the first page, and if I wasn't grabbed in the first few paragraphs, it was really hard for me to keep reading. And as a writer, I wanted to do that because I know the frustration of sending your stuff out there and of wanting the editor to actually read all the way to the end of your story. But there were some things that I could tell on the first page that the mechanics weren't there, mm-hmm. or just the writing was not up to the level that we were looking at. So unfortunately that happened. The threshold got higher and higher, but we got submissions from all over the world. I was surprised to see that. We posted the submission guidelines on Raylan.com and also on the sadly defunct Right Hemisphere, which isn't around anymore.
Oh, right.
But,
yeah.
Scott Riley's not doing it anymore, but there's a new place, Lit Haven, which has kind of taken their place. But anyway, so we publicized it a few different places, and I also put them up on, I had a Journalscape journal and a live journal, and also Jeff Vandermeer set up a corner of the Nightshade message board. So I put it up, you know, quite a bit. And,
right.
And so we got a lot of submissions. We got submissions from Greece and from Australia and from all over Europe. And so I was pretty happy to see, yeah. you know, the variety of different things that we were getting.
Well, you got some pretty big names in there as well. I mean, yeah. I have to say that I'm not nearly as well read or as versed in the field as you are, but I mean, Jeff Vandermeer springs to mind as probably one of the biggest in the book.
Yeah, he's definitely going to be one of the sellers when people actually look into this and go, "Oh, Jeff Vandermeer's in here. Maybe mm-hmm. I should take a look." But yeah, Bruce Boston, who's been writing science fiction for I think 40 years, and Reese Hughes, he's a Welsh author mm-hmm. who's been having some success lately, and he wrote...
he's got a lot of stuff in there,
doesn't
he? He
does. He gave me an astonishing amount of things in here. He originally gave me a story that was right at 5,000 words, and it was not quite what we were looking for, and it was a little dense, and so I asked him for another one, and he gave us Grumblebelly, which is in here,
mm-hmm.
Which at the end of the story has three recipes of food that was actually in his story, but then he also gave us, I think, 4 or 5 poems
right.
that were in here. So yeah, there's a lot of his stuff in here. But yeah, Jeff Vandermeer he's been a friend of mine for a few years now, and I was begging him for a story. I was like, if we can get him, you know, maybe mm-hmm. we can, you know, get some respectability here and get the bigger magazines maybe to notice us. And so he said he was working on a collaboration with Des Lewis, who is a British author, and who's an unbelievably prolific British author, and Mike Korn, who I think he lives in New Orleans, in Louisiana somewhere. So he said he was working on this Lovecraftian kind of thing with them that had a bizarre menu and some different Lovecrafty kind of things, and mm-hmm. I was like, yeah, send it to me, definitely. So and he did, and you know, it's you know, a pretty cool story anyway.
Right.
And Emerald City, Cheryl Morgan, who runs Emerald City, said that it's worth the price of the anthology alone just for that. And
well, that's one thing that's always kind of surprised me about all of the cover prices for your three books is mm-hmm. they're cheap. They're
yeah.
just dirt cheap. I can't believe you're not, and I'm sure many other people have said the exact same thing, that it's
they
amazing
have, yeah.
that you're selling it for as cheaply as you are.
Yeah, well, I've heard that from a few different places. One, Rick Kleffel, who does the Agony column, also made that comment that at $9.99, I mean, it is 180 pages, but for a small press, you know, a $10 anthology, that's pretty good. And our reasoning behind that is that we're writers. Jan and I are both writers and publishers and booksellers, whatever, but we're also readers, and one of the things that has bothered me about some small presses out there is, this is most notably in the horror small press, but also in other small presses, but that they'll bring out a book, but it'll be a limited edition, or it'll be, you know, something else, and the price will be like $45 or something for something, and it's just, for the thing that we wanted to do, we wanted to get this out to, you know, just normal Joe Schmo mm-hmm. book buyer, and so the thinking was that we were gonna, you know, we definitely wanted to cover our costs, but we didn't want to hike the price up right. too much more either, because, you know, we just like to keep things affordable for right. The people out there that are buying our stuff.
Well, writers aren't generally a rich lot anyway, so...
That's true, too.
So, that's pretty good. Yeah, yeah. I would be hard-pressed to be willing to spend $45 on a limited edition of something.
Right.
So...
I mean, there are a lot of people out there who would, mm-hmm. And I think that's why a lot of small presses are still doing it, is because they know that people will pay that much, but... for the thing that we were trying to do, and we didn't have, you know, really grand ambitions either. We just wanted to, you know, put out a cool little anthology. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we wanted to keep it as cheap as we could.
And I've heard you talk of a second printing of this. Are you considering that, or
considering,
do you have the time to do that?
Yeah, it's we're not quite sure. We have a few options. There are a few different ways that we can go. There's the company that we did our latest book, Off the Map, which is a book of short stories by Big Fish author Daniel Wallace. The company that we got to do that, it's a different company than the one that did Scattered, Covered, Smothered, mostly because the anthology, it cost... The printer that we went to was here in town in Raleigh, and they were quite expensive.
That's for Scattered, Covered, Smothered,
right? Right. And we had the covers done through Vistaprint, which is an online printer, and they came out great. But the interiors and all the binding we had done through a place here in town, and it was pretty pricey. We're barely going to break even on this one.
Right.
So we decided to go for, you know, a different printer for the next book, and
right.
And that was Chapel Hill Press, obviously, in here in Chapel Hill. And so we have an option. They can do this. They can print this one, the Scattered, Covered, Smothered. Do a second print run. It's going to be slightly cheaper. It's just a matter of, you know, if we can afford it, how many copies we think we can sell
right.
again. So there are a few different things. We haven't really talked about mm-hmm. it. So well, there is that possibility, though. You know, there have been interest, and the reviews from... I sent a bunch of copies out to reviewers, and the big ones really haven't even come out yet. So
mm-hmm.
we'll see what the demand is on whether we do it. I think we are going to, but it's just... It's either that. There's also a print-on-demand option that we were thinking about,
mm-hmm.
which would be quite a bit cheaper. I know there's I believe it's just a startup fee, and once you pay that, and once everything gets kind of set up, you know, I'm not sure how exactly it works, but there is that option of
right.
doing it print on demand as well. So, and I've been told that it will look just like this,
right.
so the quality won't be any different.
Right. Well, I would hope that a second run of this would not. Not cause the same degree of turmoil that you experienced with this one, because I remember reading in your journal number of days where you're pretty much going off on major rants about the
yeah.
binding and the print quality.
Yeah.
And those chinks, I think, or those hiccups got, well, you can't iron out hiccups, but I assume that they got ironed out.
You can try, but
you can try.
It might hurt.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was, when we first went there, when I first went there and dropped everything off, the guy was that I was dealing with, I won't name names because I was kind of trash-talking the place, but they were fine. They were, you know, he was really nice to deal with and everything, and I would call every so often and see how things were going, and he called and told me that that the proof was ready, and I think this was about 2 weeks, a week and a half, 2 weeks after I dropped everything off, and he said the proof was ready to look at. So I went down there. The place was in downtown Raleigh, so it was like 15, 20 minutes away from where I work. So I went down there after work and looked at it. And the binding... first of all, the binding, we decided to go, instead of with normal kind of like a trade paperback glued binding or something like that, because this is food-related fiction, we mm-hmm. wanted to kind of emulate, and this was Janet's idea, we wanted to emulate kind of a cookbook, and so we used this this double wiro binding. It kind of looks like spiral binding, but it's what cookbooks use, and so we wanted to use that. So anyway, so I got down there, and the diameter of the binding was too small for the book, and so when you tried to turn the pages, it would clump up, and it was just a mess after a while, and
The different meaning of the word binding.
Right. Right, exactly. So so there was that, and also we've got a few images in here. Not too many, but there are some that came out pixelated, and they didn't catch it, and they didn't call us to tell us anything about it and say, well, do you still want to run this, anything like that. He just said, here. And what I did was I took it home, and Janet looked at it and basically fell apart. She was so upset at how it looked, and she had spent so much time. She did all of the, she did the whole book design. She did the covers, all the interiors, everything. And she had spent so much time on it that to see it looking like just in such ugly condition, she just broke down in tears, and she was crying for the rest of the night. And so that, of course, upset me. So the next day I went and talked to him, and I said, look, this just is not going to work. This is, you know, we've got the problem with the binding. We've got the problem. And also with the binding that they were using is not the kind that's normally used for this wiro binding. They were using, it's kind of hard to describe, but it's a, they have the comb binding, which is, it's called GBC, where it actually looks like if you, I'm going to be really bad at describing this, but if you look at the edges, I guess, that come together, it kind of looks like a comb, maybe. So,
well, and what you're doing with your hands is almost fly trap.
Yeah, kind of like a fly trap. And so, because of that, they have, I guess, one kind of punch for when they're punching their paper. And so, because of that, because of the comb binding is kind of wide, the holes that they have to use for that on the paper are very rectangular. And the kind that Janet wanted was square, because that's the kind that she had on the things that she's gotten and that she's seen, and it's the kind that she wanted. So there was that, and I mentioned the pixelated images and things like that, and he had already run off a bunch of copies of it, and luckily he hadn't bound anything, but he'd already run off a bunch of copies, and after talking to him and just telling him how unhappy we were with this, he said, okay, well, we'll eat those copies. That was, you know, part of it was my fault for not catching that stuff when we did it. And we found out that the stuff with the pixelation of the images was actually a glitch within PageMaker, which was what we were using. When you convert files from PageMaker to PDF, that version of PageMaker that we've got, it would automatically downscale all of your images to 72 DPI.
I see. Yeah.
So everything, all the images on the inside were fuzzy, and they just looked terrible. So anyway, so after I made a fuss, he said, okay, well, we'll change this, and I had to basically make a new file for him. I had to replace the images with EPS files instead of, I think they were JPEGs before. Which are bigger, they kind of blow up the size of the book a little bit, but they're really crisp images. And so I had to redo the PDF file and give that to him. And he printed off just a quick copy and showed me, and it looked okay. And I told him about the binding, and he said, well, what we can do, this is the only kind of binding that we've got here, but I can outsource that to a bindery in town and do it that way. And I basically had to trust him at that point, and it was hard because we've been so unhappy with what he gave us before, and he should have known better. It was something that he'd put together. He should have been able to look at it and go, okay, well, wait a minute, this isn't really up to our standards. So that was the most frustrating part of it, especially for Janet, was that they didn't catch it.
Right.
And even call us about anything. So anyway, so after all that, I said, okay, just, and he said it would be done when he said it would be done. So I was like, okay, well, I'm going to just have to trust you on this. And so I went away, and when he called me and told me they were ready, he actually had them delivered to my apartment, which was nice.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah, that doesn't happen that often.
Well, actually, he said that's pretty...
The
driver said it was pretty standard practice with that company, yeah. So they got delivered. I looked through them, and everything looked great. Mm-hmm. So I'm very glad that we made a fuss about that and got them to redo it, because it was just in really crappy shape before. So,
how long was the process of the actual printing after you had accepted accepted the stories that you were going to publish? You had laid out the book in PageMaker, and then you handed it off to the printer. How long did it actually take before you had the finished product in your hand? Do you remember?
I think it was fairly quick, because we were the biggest thing, and we're not going to do this again, but the biggest thing was we wanted to get it done by Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that we had allowed enough time to do that, and we really didn't. We were really pushing it. And so I believe it was like 2.5 weeks. So it was pretty quick.
That's a pretty quick turnaround time, really, yeah.
But it was really, we should have allowed more time for that. We, like I said, we started, I think our submission period started in August, at the beginning of August, and then we went to the end of October, because I wanted to allow 3 months for people to send stuff in, and just kind of naturally as it goes, we got a lot of submissions at the beginning and a lot at the end.
Mm-hmm.
A lot at the end. People were trying to make it in before the deadline. And once we got everything, it was like right after Halloween when I finally made a decision. I had put my last few stories that I wanted to consider in a maybe file and in a accepted file. And so the maybe file was getting smaller and smaller, and I was trying to, you know, decide which ones to put in the accepted and which ones to put in the rejected. And so I did that. And so once I had all the stories picked, then I had to write up all the contracts. I asked for revisions on almost all of them, just for kind of both my and the author's sake.
Mm-hmm.
Just to make sure we had everything how we wanted it. And so some of the authors got back to us sooner than others, and so we had to wait on that before actually laying everything out. Janet had already started laying things out, but we had to wait on that, and I had to drop the contracts, which took a little while because I'm not a lawyer, so I was having to either get them from publishing contracts that I've gotten from publishers, or from there was one, I think, one on the CIFWA website, the Science Fiction Writers of America website, that they have sample contracts, and so I was also looking at theirs and saying, you know, just because I wanted to be fair to everybody. And I also, you know, gave all the authors a discount on, you know, right, certain number of books and everything. So,
well, you beat me to it, because I did at some point want to ask you a question about the whole process of contracting, you know, your authors and putting together an actual, you know, an official document. And as you say, you're not a lawyer, so that's an interesting prospect to have to suddenly be concerned with something like that.
Right.
So. Did you basically? It's a compilation of documents that you found from various
places.
Yeah,
I grabbed from some of it. The main parts of the contract were from contracts that I had gotten and that I knew were cool,
mm-hmm,
because I had agreed to them and they looked okay. So, yeah. So it was basically just assembling a whole bunch of different things, kind of piecemeal, kind of mm-hmm, a Frankenstein's document kind of thing, and just taking kind of the best from the ones that I liked. And
sure.
I also, what the biggest thing I had in there was that instead of actually a physical signature, if you returned my email, that was kind of in lieu of your signature. And
mm-hmm,
which I thought there was a story that I had at Lone Star Stories where the publisher did that. And it just makes things so much easier. I mean, just email in general was so much
sure
easier on this project. And
is that actually legally binding? I mean, the signature via email? I mean, basically just a response to the actual email message?
It is, because it's in the contract that way. It mm-hmm says in lieu of physical signatures, a reply to this email works as that way.
Right.
So, so I basically took the best parts of what I could find, and if any of the authors had a problem with them, I was happy to accommodate them, but nobody really did.
Mm-hmm.
Christopher Rowe, because we reprinted his story. His story, let me make sure I get the title right in here, because I don't want to screw it up. It's Seared Scallops and Steamed Green Beans. It's the only reprint we have, and it was one of our inspirations also in kind of doing this whole thing, is because it's a very food-oriented story.
Mm-hmm.
There was one little bit of it that he had a question about, but really and I think Nala Hopkins's recipe, she had a few questions, but really everybody was pretty pretty happy with it. So I was happy to hear that.
Most people read it.
Oh, I think so. I hope so.
Read the contract.
Yeah, I hope so. So, and some people had questions about like their physical likeness, because I mentioned that I'll have the right to use their physical likeness on the website to promote the the project, and if I wasn't sent anything by them, then I obviously couldn't use anything. So, so yeah. So it was pretty easy from everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it really was just the printing process that sounds like it was the...
That was just really the only nightmarish part. Yeah. Most of it, I mean, some of it was stressful, but... And mostly just because we didn't give ourselves... Or I didn't give ourselves enough time, because I said we will have this done by Christmas, and so because we had that deadline, we were kind of stressed on some parts of it, but really the biggest... snag for us was the printing.
Mm-hmm.
So once we got past that, it was just, you know, sell them. And
right.
once we got them all, I made sure I was at the post office. I think the next day we packed everything as much as we could, all the pre-orders and all the contributor copies. We packed up and went to the post office, which during Christmas time is going to be busy anyway, but we were there for a while, and there were some copies that we wanted to send priority mail, because they would get there in time, and so it ended up costing us a little bit more to do that, but I wanted to, you know, I wanted to retain that reputation that, you know, if we say we're going to get it done by Christmas, then we'll get it to you by Christmas.
Right.
And unfortunately, that was also when there were some blizzards going on in the country, and some people didn't get their copies until after, but... You know, I got them out when I could.
Right.
But like Barth Anderson, who is also, he submitted a story. His is the last story in the book, and he's also got two recipes co-written with his wife in here as well. And and I really, really wanted him in here, because he, in addition to being a writer, his full-time job, he works at a co-op grocery in Minnesota, and he knows a lot about food. And so I figured that... he would be able to give us a, you know, really dynamite story, and if he could give us some real recipes too, that'd
sure.
be great. And so his copies, I don't think he got his copies until like 2 weeks after I sent them, because just the mail was kind of a mess because of the blizzards. But that's how it goes.
Right.
That's the risky run with weather. But
sure.
Yeah.
Well, I have another question that is probably chronologically challenged here, because it doesn't fit the timeline that we've given here. But going back to the process of actually looking at the submissions, over lunch I was talking to you about this, and I said, save it for the interview.
Right.
But you took all of these things as emails, and that I'm sure streamlined the entire process. But you also told me that you read almost all of the stuff electronically. Now, I don't even know how... I just can't do it. I don't know how you can sit in front of a laptop and read it, but you did. Is that right?
That's right, yeah. We well, for one thing, we capped the word limit at 5,000 words, so whatever we got was not going to be too long. The 5,000 is kind of the limit of what I can read online.
5,000 words plus 200 submissions is...
That's a lot.
You could have had like a...
Well, yeah, but the thing was, the neat thing that happened was that because we didn't set a lower limit, because we like short shorts, we like flash fiction, we got a lot of short fiction entries that were less than 2,000 words.
Right.
And we've printed quite... I mean, that's why we have 30 contributors, is because we have so many shorter ones in here.
Right.
But there were... some that, I know there was one that was like 9,000 words. It's like, well, you know, read the submission guidelines. That's, you know, we're not going to even read that. But, and it was also embedded in the body of the email, which I didn't want. But yeah, I definitely wanted to read these electronically, because I just couldn't imagine.
Well, it's a tremendous amount of paper waste.
It is. It's waste.
Yeah.
And, for people to print those out, or for me to print them out, it was like, you send me your story electronically. If I like it, great. If not, I just hit delete. I don't have to throw it away. I don't have to do anything. So, yeah, so it was just so much easier to accept electronic submissions. And just what I ended up doing after I accepted all the ones I wanted, I ended up printing them out because I wanted to get an idea of just physical thickness of stories for the ordering, assembling the table of contents. So, so I wanted to make sure that I didn't have, you know, too many short stories in a row or too many long stories in a row, and and stories that have like a similar theme maybe, or they both involve bread or, you know, something like that. So, so I did print those out, but the submissions that came in, all the submissions that came in were electronic.
Right. Well, that's kind of the trend these days, isn't it? I mean, or do you, are there a lot of publishers that still require hard copies?
I think it depends. I mean, if you're looking at mainstream literary journals, a lot of them still ask for physical stories, physical printed out stories, and even the one of the biggest science fiction publishers, Sci-Fiction, which Ellen Datlow edits, she still asks for a physical copy of your story, and I can see that. I can definitely, you know, because she doesn't have quite the restraints that we do, she allows much longer stories on that site, and so so I can understand, because it's just so much easier to read something in your hand anyway, and I prefer to do that anyway.
But that's interesting, because if I understand, I don't go to the site that often, but if I understand it correctly, that's solely published online. Is that
it
right?
It is, yeah.
So that's interesting. So you're actually soliciting paper copies of writers' work, and then you're digitizing that, or I'm sure you've sent they send the file later if it's accepted, and then you put it up online.
Yeah, it's kind of a, and I haven't asked Ellen about that, but it is kind of a weird thing that you are sending a physical copy, but then it's a purely electronic publishing form, and so so then you have to digitize it, or you have to. I'm assuming that she asked for the
file.
The file, yeah. So because that would be just way too much typing, so. Yeah, but it is kind of a strange thing.
Right.
But there are a lot of places now that do accept a lot of electronic submissions.
And you were saying that you've submitted a couple of stories to the New Yorker, in fact.
Well, one, yeah.
Oh, one, okay. And they and they accept electronic submissions, right?
They do. Yeah, it's they only accept two per year from any author, but yeah, they do accept electronic submissions, which is. I think that's very progressive of the New Yorker to be able to do that. McSweeney's also does that. They accept electronic submissions.
And that's Dave Eggers?
It is, yeah. That's his publishing concern, yeah. His quirky literary journal, which is very respectable now.
Right.
Yeah, so they both accept electronic submissions and their print, you know, journals. There are, in the SF field, like Strange Horizons is one of the, I think it's one of the best online magazines out there, if not the best. I like Sci-Fiction a lot, but it doesn't feel like a magazine the way Strange Horizons does. And Strange Horizons, they update every week with a new fiction story, a new poem, a new article, new artwork, whatever. And it's just, they do a phenomenal job with it. And because they're online, they do accept online submissions or electronic submissions.
Right.
So there are a few out there, and there are a lot of the smaller zines. Like I'm trying to think of any now, but I can't. I know that Say actually and Lady Churchill's they both require paper submissions, but there are some an increasing number of zines that are actually accepting electronic ones, just because it's just. Less paperwork. It's just for that simple reason.
But I can also see the potential for getting for being just overly flooded by submissions that way. I mean, I can't help thinking that maybe by accepting electronic documents that you're opening the floodgates for all those people that otherwise would not have submitted because it's just so much easier to do. And
that is true. Yeah, it's and I'm not sure. I'm curious to actually find out what the numbers are on that. But there still are a lot of people that submit physical copies of things. But you're right, that it is much easier to shoot off an email to somebody. But it's also much easier and much less time to look over a story.
To look over
a story quickly and say, well, I don't like this, send an email right back.
Right.
I mean, the paper magazines out there, most of them take quite a while to get back. Realms of Fantasy is just terrible with their response times. They take over a year sometimes, mm-hmm. but like fantasy and science fiction, they'll usually get it back to you within a week or two, mm-hmm. which is just amazing.
And that is an electronic submission.
No, it's not. Yeah, that's a physical submission, right. which is the amazing part.
Yeah, right.
Is that either John Joseph Adams or Gordon Van Gelder will look at your story and decide, well, okay, that's not great, and then respond right away,
mm-hmm.
Which I think is a really great work ethic. And so I think that kind of translates into electronic submissions, is that... when you get something that you don't like, you don't have to wait. You can send an email right back and say, well, this isn't, you know, what I'm really looking for.
Right.
If you want to send me something else, you can.
Right.
So, and you don't have to wait on the post office, on, you know, postage and
mm-hmm.
And delivery and everything, so you can get it right away.
Right. Well, let me steer you back to your small press.
Okay.
and to the third and final... I guess product.
Well, I wouldn't say final, but
no. That's true. I mean, like third and final for right now.
You're right.
But yeah. That's not fair to say. But you didn't have the same problems with submissions on this one.
This
one was pretty easy to do, wasn't it?
Well, this was solicited by me. So mm-hmm. What happened was Off the Map, which is this little mini collection of stories by Daniel Wallace. This kind of all started, I was working at the North Carolina Literary Festival last year, which was at NC State, where I go to school, and I was working as the kind of assistant coordinator on that, and part of my job was talking to authors and making sure they knew, you know, where they were going to be, and
mm-hmm.
and because Daniel's a local author, we didn't have to worry about flying him in or anything, but we still had to worry about getting him to his event, and so I had... seen Big Fish, the movie, and mm-hmm. really, really loved it, and then picked up the book and loved it even more.
Mm-hmm.
And even though they were very, very different media and very different stories, the movie and the book are quite different. And for a reason, because the way it is written, you can't really make a movie out of that. Mm-hmm. It has to
I'll
be...
I'll have to go back and read the book then.
It is. And, yeah. Well, and for one thing, it's very short. And I've just noticed that Daniel doesn't write very long things anyway, but... That book is fairly short anyway, and but there are certain things that we were talking about that you have to have some kind of, even if it's ephemeral, but some kind of quest that your main character is going on, even if it's just personal salvation or personal growth, enlightenment, whatever,
mm-hmm.
That it doesn't have to be there in the book that he wrote, but it did have to be there in the movie, so...
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so I'd really enjoyed the movie and the book, and so I ended up getting his other books and really liked them as well. And so I was a big fan of his, and so when it came to organizing his event, which was at the theater on campus, which was they were going to have a thing where he was going to talk for about an hour, maybe less than that, and then show Big Fish after mm-hmm. that. And anybody could attend, and so... to kind of organize his part of it, I contacted him, I emailed him, and just made sure he knew what was going on. And I also asked him a question about the end of Big Fish, which I won't spoil here for anybody, but there's a very significant difference in the end of the book to the movie,
mm-hmm.
Just thematically. And so I asked him this kind of complicated question, and he wrote back, he's like, wow, okay, that's very complicated. And he actually emailed John August, who was the screenwriter for the movie, and who adapted the book into the screenplay, and he wrote back as well and kind of gave me what, you know, I was just telling you kind of the differences of why they had to be different.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I got to the event, he obviously knew who I was, and as he was signing books beforehand, we were chatting a little bit, and I asked if I could interview him sometime, and he was like, oh yeah, okay, sure. So I had his email address, so that was great, and so I decided to do an email interview with him, and so I did. I did that last summer, and... it was just kind of this, you know, one at a time. I would ask him a question, he would answer it, and sometimes that would generate another question. I had kind of a general list of what I wanted to talk about, but I wanted to make sure it was organic and not stiff and boring like mm-hmm. A lot of interviews are out there that I see. So, yeah, so we did that over a number of months, and I sent it to Strange Horizons, and they bought it, and it went up, I think, in October or so. And during the course of the interview, I found out that there weren't any plans to collect his short fiction, because I've read a few of his short stories, but it's kind of hard to get them because they're in a lot of different, you know, venues, mm-hmm. and not always very accessible. And so I was just really curious about just any kind of collection that he was going to do, because I love story collections. I love short stories anyway. And the unfortunate fact is that a lot of big publishers don't want to do them mm-hmm. because they don't sell as well, because readers generally want something that's thick that also they can, you know, stay in the world for a while, like a novel.
Something meatier, something big fishier.
Right, right, yeah. Just something that they can inhabit for a while. And unfortunately, short stories, especially if you have a whole bunch of them, they're going to be more ephemeral. They're going to be, you know, not quite as meaty.
Right.
So publishers, unless you're a big name, like Stephen King or Margaret Atwood or somebody, are going to be reluctant to do a short story collection. But I thought, geez, here's this guy who wrote this book that was made into this huge movie
mm-hmm.
that a lot of people have seen, that Tim Burton directed, and it was just a really phenomenal movie that a lot of people enjoyed. And the big publishers don't want to do a collection of his stuff. You know, how is that even possible? And so I was talking to him about, well, what if we did one? And not just a full-blown collection, but just like a mini collection, like mm-hmm. four or five stories, something like that. And I was originally thinking we'd do it as a chapbook again, which is just a, you know, just a folded booklet, basically.
Right.
And so we kind of went back and forth. He sent this one story that was quite long. It was, I guess, about 8,000 words, and he was thinking that we could do it just as that one story. But I really wanted to do something that was more of, you know, a few stories that
mm-hmm.
That collected a few things that were out there, and maybe that were older, that weren't even around anymore. And he ended up actually selling that story to One Story Magazine, which is a really cool thing. I think it's every week they put a new issue, quote-unquote issue, which is one story.
Mm-hmm.
And I know recently his came out. So he ended up sending me three stories. And I really liked them, and I said, well, is there any way that we can get one more from you? And so he sent one more, and we started, you know, going through the process of editing. He had his mother-in-law, who the book is actually dedicated to, help him with the editing, and with any... Because I did a prototype proof and sent it to him, and got it back with, you know, corrections and anything that he wanted changed. And because three out of the four have already been published, but one is actually original to the collection, which I think is really cool.
That is really cool.
Vacation, which is actually the longest story in there. So got that back, and we kind of went back and forth on you know, how it was going to look. And we decided that because he, for a long time, he made his living as an illustrator, that he would do the artwork for it. And so he drew up sketches for the four interior drawings that accompanied each story, and then also the cover art. So so we started to get that all together and put it, I did all the layout for this one and put it all together, and we decided to make it a trade paperback instead of just a chapbook,
mm-hmm.
Just because it would look nicer, and frankly, we'd be able to charge a little bit more,
right?
Because people are willing to pay more for that. So we ended up going with that format, and the publisher or the printer that we went through, Chapel Hill Press, was able to do that, and he had actually done a limited edition illustrated book called Oh Great Rosenfeld, which is being published in, I think, France and Italy right now, and he's hoping to get it published here in the States.
Mm-hmm.
But he did a run for friends and family as, I think, a Christmas present
mm-hmm.
Through them, And while I was there, like, looking at the different books that they had done, I saw that one, and I saw, well, they definitely know what they're doing, so, you know, we'll give them the job.
Well, I was amazed, I mean, because to me, it seems like this came directly on the heels of your last one. I was really surprised, because, you know, Scattered, Covered, Smothered came out in December, and, you know, here we are at the beginning of February, and this is already done. You've got...
Well, technically, the publication date on that is March, so we're a little bit early on it. But yeah, we had I and Janet wishes this too. I wish we could have pushed it a little bit farther out because it did come so soon off of the other book, and that's I guess the main reason why I did I tried to do as much as I could so I wouldn't have to pressure her to do even more design and that kind of thing. So. She did do the cover design and the color on it because he sent us a black and white drawing. So she did all the color and all the design for that, but the interiors were me, so I take full responsibility for that, good or bad. So yeah, so it did come out pretty soon, and we're not gonna do that again because that did create some more pressure that we didn't really need. I thought it was gonna be enough time for us to put it together, and there were a few stressful moments on that one as well. But I think most of the reason why I wanted to get it out when I did was I was just really happy about this project and really excited about it and wanted to get it out there and get it into people's hands. And so I think my eagerness was kind of clouding my judgment there on a deadline for it. But yeah, it's middle of February and it's done already. So yeah, and we've got a few events coming up. We've got some readings at some local bookstores that we're going to try and promote it, and there's a big reading in, like I was telling you, in Alabama in April, that they ordered a bunch of copies.
Right.
So, this one, we are, like the other two, we're very approaching selling out on this one as well.
How many did you do of this one?
This one, we went to 250. I was thinking about 300, but again, I mean, I know he's a big seller, but again, just that wariness, I was not sure. Mm-hmm. If we were going to do a whole bunch of these, that we'd have a lot left over and, you know, a lot of money out the window kind of thing. So anyway, so I did 250, and we're probably going to have to go back to press on this one as well.
How are you getting these distributed?
Mostly through our website. We haven't had to use, because we're not going through any of the distributors like Ingram or Baker & Taylor or anything like that. We're not really aiming this for the bookstores. The ones that the independent bookstores that I'm contacting I'm contacting them, so I'm not having to worry about a distributor for that.
And that's pretty much true of all of the books that you two have published, right? You're
it
not
is.
Necessarily looking for bookstores, you're looking at small independent booksellers.
That and
web
just
sales.
Hand selling it. Yeah. Most of our sales on the other two, not on the third one, but on the first two books were through the website, and it was just me promoting it and me going to different conventions or printing out flyers or emailing people or whatever and just promoting the hell out of it. And so with Scattered, Covered, Smothered, I'm very lucky that we lucky in many ways that we had Jeff Vandermeer on this, because he also really got excited about the idea of the book, and so he's also been, you know, promoting it quite
well. He's an incredible promoter anyway. I mean, it seems like every website I go to that has something to do with fiction has got a Jeff Vandermeer flash banner on it somehow, you know. So how does he do it? But
You'd have to ask him that, but he's really good at it. And he also knows, because he had, well, he is, I suppose he still has it, but he's got the Ministry of Whimsy, which is his own small press. And he's had that for a long, long time, and at one point it was, I believe, an imprint of Prime Books, and then it was also an imprint of Nightshade Books, but now I think he's back to it being just itself again.
Autonomous.
And I don't think he's going to be doing anything with it for the foreseeable future, so he can concentrate on writing.
Did you get any sort of... Actually, this brings me to a good question. At least I think it's a good question. Did you get any sort of advice from anyone when you were doing your small press? I mean, did Jeff give you any advice, or did you just fly by the seat of your pants on this one, and pretty much
it was very seat of the pants kind of going. Jeff gave me a lot of advice once we had gotten going on the anthology. Once he was involved and we knew he was going to have a story in it, I asked him a lot of questions. Mm-hmm. Some regarding contracts, like one of the big things was for like discounts for the contributors, because I hadn't even thought about that. I was oblivious to that idea, because I just didn't even think about that. I was mm-hmm. like, oh yeah, our contributors might want to buy copies for relatives, for family, whatever. So there was that, and we were talking about different printing methods. And he's a big proponent of print on demand. He's mm-hmm. got a few books through Prime Books, which is print on demand.
Right.
So he's a heavy proponent of that. And so we were talking about that a little bit. But he was just really good at giving me some little tips on the end things, on promotion, on where to send review copies.
Right.
He sent me this huge list of reviewers that he's kind of aggregated over the years mm-hmm. from when he was doing Ministry of Whimsy stuff, that just all over the place, not just in genre like Locus and Realms of Fantasy and the magazines that are in the field, but also New York Times and Washington Post and mm-hmm. Publishers Weekly and the big guys. So I didn't use those, but I was able to use, I think, 12 of the reviewers on his list to send out review copies, and we've only really gotten 3 so far, but I'm hoping for more every day.
Sure, sure.
So I'm hoping that once those other ones come out, that it also provokes some more sales, and people go, oh, okay, well, this was in Locus this month, which actually we will have a review in Locus in March.
Mm-hmm.
I believe Rich Horton's doing a review, so hopefully that will get some more people to go, oh, okay, this sounds interesting, I'll
sure.
do this. So.
Well, that's great.
Yeah.
That's great. But speaking of the same topic, there's just been a question I've been dying to ask you, because I don't know whether any time down the road I might be able to foresee doing something similar. I think it's a great undertaking, just the whole control that you have
right.
Behind it is I'm sure a wonderful and at times also a very very nerve-wracking thing.
It is, because you're doing everything yourself.
Right.
And I know with the first book, that was, we really wanted to put out something that was ours and that we could control how it looked and how it was presented. And I know Kelly Link, who I cannot say enough good things about, mm-hmm. that was her main reason for doing her first collection. Oh God, I'm going to mess up the name now. I'll get it later.
Yeah.
Her first collection anyway, and it should be on the tip of my tongue, but I've forgotten it. She did through Small Beer Press, which she runs with her husband, Gavin Grant.
Mm-hmm.
And technically, that makes it self-publishing, but the quality was just immensely good. It was just the cover art, the interior, everything was just really, really, really well done. And they're into, like, 6th printing, I think, of it now.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, they sent copies to Salon, to a whole bunch of different places, and it got reviewed pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
And she's a phenomenal writer, and I can understand why, it did as well as it did, but she really wanted to control how it looked and
mm-hmm.
how it came out, and she wanted the cover artist to be Shelley Jackson, who is a writer as well as an artist, and
mm-hmm.
so she wanted it to look a certain way. In her second collection, Magic for Beginners, I know that's coming out either this year, or I think this year, the summer of this year, is also through Small Beer, and
mm-hmm.
I think it's a really good decision on her part, because both her and Gavin know what they're doing,
right.
and they can control everything as far as that goes.
Right, and I think that hopefully will allow me to ask the question I originally wanted to pose to you.
Stranger Things Happen. There it is.
Oh, is that it?
That's her collection.
Okay.
Yeah, Stranger Things Happen. I knew I'd get it.
But I wanted to ask you, if for all of those control freaks out there who do want to do this sort of thing and have complete control of what it is that they're doing, what kind of advice would you have for someone who would like to put together their own small press or publish some of their own material, or anyone else's for that matter, as you've done with Scattered, Covered, Smothered, and the Daniel Wallace book?
Well, one thing is to make sure that you're not locked into any one printer. Like I said, with the Scattered, Covered, Smothered, we are just barely going to break even on it. But with Off the Map, because we went with Chapel Hill Press, they are not just a printer, they outsource all of their stuff out. And so they can get really competitive bids on printing and binding and that kind of stuff. And they do a lot of their stuff, I believe, in Wisconsin and Michigan. And so they're not tied into using just North Carolina printers. They can go all over the country. And I know in Wisconsin and in Michigan, I know their prices there are much, much better. And so they can offer you much cheaper prices than like what we got for the anthology.
Mm-hmm.
So I think just, you know, making sure that you shop around and that you know what the good printers are out there, and also just knowing what you can do and accepting your own limitations on what you can do. If you want to put together an anthology or a zine and you know squat about design, get somebody who does, or learn it. Take a class and learn it. Because that's the first thing that people are going to look at is how it's put together.
Sure.
Before they even peek inside, they're going to see, okay, well, this is kind of shoddy and the pages are falling out, and so I'm not going to even bother plunking my $5 or $10 down for this thing. So there's just the knowledge of your own limitations and knowing what you can do. And also to give yourself realistic expectations and don't set deadlines that are hard deadlines like we did, unfortunately. So, because you'll drive yourself crazy if you do. But also, we're very lucky that that we're in this really great community of writers and publishers, and we go to conventions a lot. We'll be going to WisCon this year, and hopefully World Fantasy also. But like the first book, Four Seasons in One Day, we debuted it at World Fantasy Con in Washington.
I remember that.
Yeah, and Michael Jasper, who he's also a local writer, he did Intracities, which was an anthology that I actually had a story in, but he organized this small press party for one night during World Fantasy Con. And so there were, God, I don't even remember how many of us were there. There were like, I think 15, maybe? 15 small presses there, and we all had our books around, and because it was a party, we were able to have like booze and stuff, and so of course some people came just for the booze and that kind of thing, but there were a lot of people. I sold quite a few copies of that thing, and it was people who just wanted to browse around and look and see what the small press has to offer. So part of it is the connections, is just to get out there and to email people. If you know anyone ever has any questions for me, they can always email me and ask how I did something. That's kind of how this interview is going as well.
Sure.
And just to make connections and just to see how people are doing things and what their pitfalls were and what to avoid and just to kind of create that network. So when you do have something to produce, not only will you have taken the advice of people who have done this, but you'll also have people who might be interested in buying it.
Right. Well, I think you have just an incredible root structure, actually. I mean, when you look at your journal, I mean, I don't know how many hits a day your journal gets, but I'm sure it's a huge amount. But I know that having looked through the comment section, that you have just tons of different people commenting on your entries at times. But I can't help thinking that a lot of that comes from your ties to science fiction and fantasy and spec fiction.
Yeah.
I know you've done a lot of schools, or you've done some of the writing schools. You had Clarion, and you were just telling me about the was it Strange Horizons workshop out in Oregon last year.
Right.
I mean, you meet a lot of people. I assume that having met these people, that gets them dialoguing with you on your website as well, and then they know about the product, the books that you're publishing, and then they tell other people. That probably some of the people that you've met have actually submitted to this one too.
Right, and that's also part of it too, is if you're going to start like a magazine or an anthology or something, is the more people you know, the more you can email personally and say, look, I'm putting this together, would you mind sending me something? Because you know that you're going to get a certain amount of quality from people. So especially with like Barth Anderson and Reese Hughes and Jeff Vandermeer, I knew I was going to get good stuff from them, and so I pushed hard. And they were able to give me some really just phenomenal stuff in here, as well as all the other stories in here.
Sure.
So yeah, I definitely heartily recommend, you know, whenever you go to conventions, just to talk to people and not to badger them, but to, you know, just to talk and even online. I mean, a lot of people through my journal, I've actually just converted over to LiveJournal after being on JournalScape for a really long time, almost 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
I am, because I just redesigned my website and I stripped so much down from, I think it was like 100 individual pages, and it's down to like 6 now.
Mm-hmm.
So I really wanted to, when I did that, I really wanted to kind of take everything down to the bare minimum. And because of that, I also wanted my journal to kind of be incorporated in the format that I'd done. And unfortunately, JournalScape is a little limited as far as like embedding your journal kind of thing. So, and I did have a live journal for a while, and so I ended up doing that. But the community through JournalScape has just been phenomenal. It was started by Jen Reese and Kenny Smith, who live in California. And Jen Reese is a writer. She's a really talented, fantastic writer, who, because of who she knows, she said, well, you know, why don't you take a look at this thing? The reason I got on there was because Mike Jasper got on there.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw his journal, and I was like, oh, that's kind of cool looking. Maybe I'll do mine there.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that JournalScape has a very high proportion of
writers.
Of working writers,
yeah.
That young kind of in our generation writers.
Mm-hmm.
That and we all comment on each other's journals and everything. And so I feel kind of bad that I'm not going to be, and I still might use JournalScape every once in a while, but I feel kind of bad that I don't feel like I'm abandoning them, but it's at the same time I kind of do a
mm-hmm.
little bit. But just LiveJournal right now is just a little bit more robust for what I want to do. But but part of that was just the community and talking on, commenting on different journal entries that people have got, and then meeting these people in person. Like I met Jen Reese at the World Fantasy Con that I was just talking about.
Right.
And we had a blast. She's just a really fun person.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just that talking to people and just participating in that community.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just at a blogging convention yesterday, conference here in Chapel Hill. And that was the big topic, was blogging as community. And I think it's really, really true of the JournalScape community that we had, is that
sure.
just so many of us would comment and just participate in each other's, you know,
daily lives, really.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, whenever there was something like somebody had gotten a story accepted, everyone would send congratulations. Or if somebody's mother was in the hospital, we would send, you know, condolences and say we hope they're going to pull through and kind of thing. And so it's a really, really nice tool. To be able to kind of create communities online, and a lot of writers are using them. I know on LiveJournal a lot do as well, because
mm-hmm.
I've had a few. I know Sonia Taffy is there, and Catherine Valente, and Nick Mamatas, the...
oh, yeah, I've heard of him. I think Mike Jasper actually put me on.
Yeah, the rabble-rouser Nick Mamatas. He's I know he's in California now. He was in New York for a long time, but he...
Mm-hmm.
He's a very unique guy, but he's on LiveJournal, and Nicholas Kaufman, a bunch of people are there. So there's a community there as well, and I'm hoping that I can also bring some of my readers, some of my community members over, not bring them over, but just have them, you know, still look at my stuff and comment and participate.
Right. Well, we've been at this quite a while now. I'm not sure how long, but
yeah, wow.
it's been good.
Yeah.
But I wanted to ask you one final question before we wrap this up. I mean, do you have any future projects already planned for Two Cranes Press? Or
we don't. We're gonna, after this book, we're gonna take a rest for a while, because
mm-hmm.
We've got a few events coming up. We've got a big reading / eating event at a bookstore here in Chapel Hill, Internationalist Books, which you're going to be at. And at the end of February, we've got a few readings for the Wallace book at the beginning of March at Quail Ridge Books and The Regulator, and those are all on my website and on the twocranespress.com website. And so I think we're going to take a break after this for a while, because we're also, I'm waiting to hear from PhD programs, and so it's a little up in the air where we're going to be in August, and so it's just one more thing if we keep doing publishing projects right now.
Sure.
That's just kind of a stress factor. So I think we're going to take a little bit of a break. This definitely is not the end. I think, you know, we have a lot of fun doing this. We definitely need to allow more time for projects, and that's definitely more my fault than it is Janet's at all. Mm-hmm. So there will definitely be some stuff from us in the future, but a little break for a little while.
Right.
I mean, there's some authors that I would love to assemble a chat book. There are some that are friends of mine and some that are not.
Mm-hmm.
That I would love to be able to publish their stuff, but you know, we'll see how it goes.
Well, great.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, Jason. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for having me, man.
Yeah, I would probably be a really bad or maybe even a good interviewer if I didn't end on a line like this, but let's not have too much of a break. I'm saying that as with as much sarcasm as I can muster.
Well,
No, you know, really, seriously, though, these are great books, and I'm sure that the people that have bought them know that, and we'll look forward to the fourth one.
Well, thank you very much, man. That's nice of you. And that's been our big goal through all this. I mean, we want to put something out there that we're really proud of, and, mm-hmm. and quality is definitely part of that. So we want the highest quality that we can possibly get.
Right. Well, I think you've gotten that.
All right, man.
Yeah. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. I'm going to hit the stop button.
Okay.